Okay, folks, we're just coming up on 7:30, so welcome all to the June 7th Q&A for the OPCUG. Any new people with us tonight, welcome. We welcome guests. If you want to become a member, if you look in the chat window, there's a link there where you can go to join our group. It's only $20 a year. And I'm now going to mute all. You will have the ability to unmute yourself. Please feel free to do so. If you have a comment or a question, please remute yourself afterwards so we keep background noise to a minimum. Later on this evening, the contents of the chat window, the audio track, and the PDF of the deck that is being presented tonight will go up on our website, so you can review all of that at your leisure. And with that, I will turn it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck.
Okay, thanks, Chris. So we have quite a bunch of different material tonight, and I'm actually going to throw it right back to Chris, because the first item is a question that came in about disk storage.
Hey, just for a sec. Okay. So, yeah, this is a question that came in from B. Alt, who's on the call tonight. So I hope we answer your question. Feel free to chime in if you need additional details. So the email that came in, B said that she was looking for suggestions for good deals on storage media. And she has two needs for it: Sirius scan photo storage in the terabytes and USB drive for moving things. And I took some liberties at what that actually meant, but we'll go through what my thoughts are on it. And I hope anybody else will chime in as well. So we're going to talk about three different media. Hard disk drives, or HDDs, and those are physical spinning platters. Solid-state drives, which are electronics that are made to look like a spinning hard drive to the operating system. And then we'll look at flash drives as well. And next, you'll see there, I've been using DALL-E for a whole bunch of graphics that I've been using in my slides. And this is very strange, just complete aside to the topic at hand. But I went to DALL-E and I said, give me a sketch of a woman looking at a tall stack of external hard drives. And I thought it was kind of curious that they gave her three arms. Anyhow, next. So some of the considerations that I think are front and center when you're looking at storage media for your computer. One is speed. And basic rules here are that SSDs are faster than HDDs, so solid-state drives faster than hard disk drives, because the hard disk drives have spinning platters, and so they are a lot slower. And they are faster than flash drives as well, which is just due to the types of memory and the controllers that they put in them. And then flash drives are actually faster, typically, than hard disk drives will be. Next. Portability is another consideration. Now, in this deck, I'm talking mostly or pretty much exclusively about external drives. If you're looking for storage expansion and you're not worried about portability at all, then there is a chance that internal drives, if you've got a desktop computer, might be your best option. Not terribly practical when it comes to a laptop in most cases, that you can't add an additional internal drive. But just keep that in mind, that if you don't need portability, it's worth looking at internal drives. Next. The other things that we want to talk about in terms of portability. So flash drives are going to be the most portable. And the reason is that they are the smallest, lightest, and they don't take any external power supply to it. You just plug them into a USB port and you're off and running. And they can be so small that they barely stick out of the USB port. An external solid-state drive would be the most portable next in line. So they tend to be the smallest that are bigger than flash drives. Also don't require external power supply in order to drive them. Then you go into external portable hard disk drives as being the next most portable. They're basically the same in terms of they don't require external power supplies, but they will be bigger than an external solid-state drive will be. And then the largest of them is going to be the external desktop hard disk drive, and they're physically bigger, and they're going to be physically bigger, and also they do require a separate power supply that you have to plug into an outlet. The other consideration that I tend to look at is capacity. And the maximum capacity that you can get out of these will vary by the form factor, and I'll go into some more detail on that. Next.
Just going back to your three-hand slide, Jocelyn says that artificial intelligence is known to give hands with any number of fingers.
Oh, that's cool. Okay, so here I have some typical capacity and the pricing for the different media that I've been talking about. And I'm going to talk to the two red boxes first. So the first red box at the top, the table is actually ranked according to the different form factors, the maximum capacity. And it turns out that in this chart, the largest maximum capacity is at the top and the lowest is at the bottom. And then the cost per terabyte, it turns out that the lowest cost per terabyte is at the top and the highest cost per terabyte is at the bottom. Now, going down to the bottom box for a moment here, when I did this, I was just looking at it today, and I concentrated on looking at what is the lowest price for the maximum capacity and the minimum capacity for each of the form factors, and I basically ignored the ones in the middle. Now, I also ignored a few instances where we had things like unusually low price for a single item that was on sale typically. If I saw a bunch that are on sale at a given low price, I would include it. But if it was something that is a one-off that you may or may not see that sort of price in the future, I didn't bother with it. So there are many different capacities that you will find at each of these form factors, and you'll have different price points available. And often I find that the sweet spot or the lowest cost per terabyte is really in the middle of the capacity of any form factor. So just keep that in mind as you look at actual buying this stuff. Prices are all over the map. And I will say that it was the pricing that I have here was obtained from very quick cursory look at a couple of websites today. So if we look at the actual chart, the form factor, so desktop hard disk drives, typically they run in a range of about 5 terabytes to 20 terabytes. There's not many at 20. There are quite a few when you get to 18 terabytes, though. And the cost was running from $150 for a 5 terabyte up to about $600 for a 20 terabyte. I saw some 18 terabytes at about $400 or $450, which is not bad. So on the chart there, cost per terabyte is about $30 per terabyte. Portable hard disk drives, they are smaller. So you run from about 1 terabyte to 5 terabytes. You can find some 500 gigabyte ones. I wouldn't bother. You save about $5 or $10, and that's it. So the 1 terabyte drives, you can get them for about $70, and 5 terabyte drives go to $150, sometimes a little bit more than that. So the cost per terabyte has jumped from $30 to about $70 per terabyte. Solid-state drives, which are really attractive because they're very fast, small, lightweight, they're smaller still. So you go from about 500 gigabytes up to 4 terabytes, and the cost is $90 to $400, or equating into a cost per terabyte of about $100 to $180. And then the flash drives are the most expensive in the cost per terabyte, and they're also the smallest capacity, 32 gigabytes to 512 gigabytes. And so costs running around $10, going up to about $120 for 512 gigabyte, and that equating out to about $240 to $310 per terabyte. Again, these are just, you know, a snapshot on time, on looking at a couple of websites, but it gives you sort of the range and how they vary. Next.
Tom has put a link in the chat with Canadian disk prices. It's a site called diskprices.com.
Okay.
I haven't seen that, but it might be worth looking at if you're interested in buying disks.
Yep. Okay, some other considerations that I think everybody should look at when they're looking at adding storage media. First and foremost, I think, is backup. If the information you put on this external, extra storage is important to you, make sure you have a backup strategy for it. And we've talked about backup a number of times at Q&A and in general meetings, things like that. There are newsletter articles I've written and Alan has written on backup strategies. And so I highly recommend that you consider that. Next. Security. So consider encryption for anything that's sensitive, in particular if this is going to be a device that is going to leave your home. So if it's in your home, you do have locks on the door and things like that. And if a robber gets into your house, then you got bigger things to worry about than specifically that one external drive that you have on your computer. But if you take this with you when you go places, you know, there's more of a chance of loss or theft. And so consider encryption if you have anything that is sensitive nature on that particular device. Next. Flash drives. I have a bit of bugaboo for flash drives. I love flash drives. I use them all the time. I've got lots of them. But they are notoriously prone to failure. I've had quite a few fail on me. And so my rule of thumb is you put nothing on a flash drive that doesn't exist somewhere else. So I use them primarily for transferring information from one location to another location. And if something exists on that flash drive, it exists somewhere else. So that not if it fails, but when it fails, I actually have not lost any of my data. Next.
That's probably not a bad rule for any drive, actually.
True. Okay, one other thing I want to say about flash drives, and this we talked about this at previous at Q&A. I just put it into the chat window there. There are many fakes out there. So be very careful when you go to places like eBay, Temu, Amazon, so forth, and you see really unrealistically low prices or especially unrealistic high capacities. There are no legitimate flash drives over 512 gigs. Okay. So when you see, you know, an ad for a 2 terabyte flash drive, it is a fake. So if you're concerned about that or you want to know more about it, take a look at that PowerPoint deck and the recording that went along with it from January 5th of 2022. Next.
Tim has a note that there's a 32 gig flash drive at Dollarama for $4.50.
Yeah. I mean, it's amazing what they're going for now. So in summary, the way I would sort of place these various media, a desktop hard disk drive is, to me, it's ideal if you don't need portability because it has to be plugged into a power supply or you don't need very high speed. So, I mean, hard disk drives can still be pretty quick, but there are faster options if you need really high speed. If you need big capacity, there are 20 terabyte desktop hard disk drives. You can also build a RAID array of any size that you want. So if you need large capacity, desktop hard disk drive is the way to go. And it is the lowest cost per terabyte. So that's where it really shines in those three bullet points. Next. The next thing I think is the desktop portable hard disk drive. If you don't need capacity over 5 terabytes, is what they typically are topping out at this point in time, you might be able to find them a little bit larger than that, but generally they top out at 5 terabyte, and you don't need the high speed of a solid-state drive, then a desktop portable hard drive can be good. If you want the convenience of a small size, and again, and no power brick for it. So they are very convenient for that. So portable hard disk drive, to me, that's where they fit in place. Next.
Now, they're really useful if you have a laptop and you need more storage or backup.
Exactly. Yep. Solid-state drives are really great if you want either really high speed, you can get very, very fast solid-state drives, and or you need a very small size. So physically, they are probably about a quarter of the volume of a desktop portable hard disk drive, maybe slightly above that. And if you don't need capacity over 4 terabytes, because currently solid-state drives are topping out at about 4 terabytes. Next. Lastly, I think flash drives are really great if you want easy transfer of information from one computer or device to another device. Really good for just doing that. Just one off, bang, bang, you move the file around, and you're done. If you don't care about reliability, now, it's kind of funny to say that because most people, you always care about reliability. But with flash drives, I don't count on them very much at all. Again, nothing on flash drives that doesn't exist somewhere else, and because they do fail on a pretty periodic, regular basis. And if you don't need capacity over 512 gigabytes, again, if you see an ad for a flash drive that says it's over 512 gigabytes, almost guaranteed that it is a fake. And it is reporting that it's bigger than that. It is not bigger than that. It will either overwrite your data or it will just toss it in the bin. So that's what I have for that. Oh, yeah, shop the sales because they are always on sale. So no matter what it is you're looking for, whether it's a desktop hard disk drive or a solid-state drive or a flash drive, there's always something on sale, and you can get some real screaming deals sometimes.
I'm wondering if I could just add, Chris, to something you said. So I'm a little bit familiar with some of the things Bea wants to do, not everything, but she and I have been talking about her photos. And I just wanted to mention, Bea, that in the context of the comment on the 32-gigabyte flash drive for $4.50, that would hold 1,000 of the photos you're scanning. Okay, so maybe you've got 3,000 photos, but of the size you told me, that would, you know, you could easily put 1,000 just on the 450 flash drive, as long as you have it someplace else too. And just to mention, the solid state drive isn't necessarily going to speed up your scanning process, which I know you find slow. So Chris can correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think it would necessarily make that much faster.
No, in actual fact, it's going to have a negligible effect on that. Okay. The amount of time it takes to scan stuff is in the scanning,
that's
not
it.
The storing of the file that results from
it. I didn't want her to run out and get one thing.
Yeah,
she's going to have fast
scanner. If you're looking for a lot of capacity to just store stuff, like really that desktop hard disk drive, if you're scanning, you're probably, you know, you've got it on your desktop, right? It's sitting there. You can plug it into a power supply, no problem at all. That is probably the ideal solution to that, is a desktop hard disk drive, and get the capacity that you need. And you can start at about 5 terabytes at a very, very inexpensive price point.
Now, Chris,
that's actually a good point, Chris. I think, you know, you talk about 20 terabyte drives, but if you only need a couple of terabytes or maybe 4 terabytes, it's actually going to be a lot cheaper to buy 2 4-terabytes or 2 8-terabytes than 1 20 maybe.
Yep, exactly.
And you have a lot of backup capability as well.
Yep.
Yeah, you can double up, yeah.
Now, Chris, you said, I'm not sure, I just must have not understood this. You said flash drives are faster than hard disk drives. But what do you mean by that? Because it's sure not faster when you're copying or writing or reading.
Well, it depends on the flash drive and the interface as well.
Oh, okay.
A lot of flash drives, especially the cheaper ones, are USB 2.
Oh, okay.
And they are relatively slow. Okay. If you get a USB 3 or 3.1 flash drive, it can actually be pretty speedy.
Okay. So that it would have to be 3 or – yeah, okay.
Yeah.
In general, flash drives should be faster than spinning drives, shouldn't they?
It depends on the interface, but
yeah.
Yes, I think I see a lot of flash drives that are USB 2. I don't see a lot of hard disk drives that are USB 2. They'll almost all be USB 3. You have to watch that as well.
Okay. So Tom has a note here in the chat about that some laptops and some desktops have built-in slots for either an SD or a micro SD card. And when you plug them in, they don't stick out very much. So they're really good for portability.
Yeah.
And it does give you extra storage, or it gives you backup capability kind of on the fly. So I use SD cards which have come out of old cameras.
Yeah.
You know, so it doesn't actually cost me anything. It's a way to use up the flash drives I have or the SD cards I have.
Yeah. One thing I caution a little bit, I don't think that, I know that in particular flash drives are not really meant to be used as a constant thing. You shouldn't be reading and writing from them constantly. For one thing, you'll find that they heat up quite a bit, and I think they are more prone to failure. And I suspect that SD cards are probably the same thing, that, occasional writes to it are fine, but, you know, you don't want to have it in play where you're constantly reading and writing. Well, reading is probably not a big deal, but you're not constantly writing to that device. Whereas solid-state drives and hard disk drives can last for a lot of writes.
Yeah, Bob Walker here.
I've
had a couple of SanDisk 512 gigabyte flash drives, the little wee ones that just stick out slightly from your laptop. And one of them, if you got to putting a lot of information on it at once, overheated to the point where the plastic housing melted.
Wow.
And it still works fine, but I use it for a backup of a backup now. I can't really trust it anymore. And I've since had a couple more that they heat up, but not nearly to that extent. And now they work fine. And also, I remember a couple of years ago, I did a review of a Western Digital passport. Drive that 4 terabytes at the time was about $130. Now it's down to less than $120. It's smaller than a pack of cigarettes. If anybody remembers how big a pack of cigarettes is, and I've had it for a couple years now. Works great. 4 terabytes is lots and lots and lots of capacity. So, and the other thing on the desktop hard disk drives, there are some available, especially from Western Digital, that have 2 hard disk drives in the casing, and you can either mirror them, in which case they back up each other. So if one of the hard drives dies, you can pop a fresh one in, and it'll copy the contents of the second one over to the new one, or you can what they call stripe them, or have them operate separately. So that's another option.
You can also get housings for your old disk drives from obsolete computers, especially laptops. That laptop hard drives don't take much power. They can easily connect by USB, and they're fairly small. But you can also probably get ways to reuse bigger drives, like the 3.5-inch ones, perhaps in a NAS or something like that. So your old disk drive can serve as a tertiary backup.
You can get enclosures for those bigger drives too.
Yeah. One other thing I'd like.
For portability at higher to mid capacity, he's been using internal SSDs from old PCs. So I imagine he's been using an enclosure to make it into an external USB drive. And Bill says, reminds us if you question the capacity of the drive, like if you think you might have a fake drive, there's a utility called H2TestW, which will actually confirm the actual size of the drive.
One final
says it's important for things like photos it's good to have at least 3 copies on different devices. And if one is off-site or stored to online storage, in the cloud, that is, then that will be even better. And Tristan says, anybody who has an Amazon Prime subscription, you get unlimited resolution photo backups.
One last thing I'll say on SSDs, I guess this comes from doing the presentation slides today. For SSDs, there's one other factor that can come into play, which I think could be important, is the durability of the actual physical media. SSDs, because of the fact that they have no moving parts, you can drop them, you can run over them with a car or whatever, and they will survive. The HDDs, hard disk drives, because they have moving parts and that, you have to be a little bit more careful with them. I'm a real big fan of the Samsung T7 solid-state drives. They're really small, compact, they're fast, reliable. So if you want high speed, reasonable capacity, looking at those SSDs, if you don't mind paying a little bit of an extra premium, they can be really, really nice drives to have.
Chris, this little thing here in my hand.
Yep, I've seen those. Yep.
Yeah, it's an SSD.
Yep.
1 terabyte. It's more portable than the hard drive, portable hard drives.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah, the portable SSDs are really, really tiny, and they'll fit in a pants pocket or shirt pocket. No problem at all. You know, it's just, yeah, nice drives.
Could I just ask, when you say constant use of a flash drive, I mean, do you mean if you put a few things on a day, or do you mean if you, like, run it for 5 minutes?
No, this is if you're using it. Well, it'll never end up happening that it gets used by the operating system in that way. But if you were to use it as your swap drive for an operating system or something like that, where it is basically constantly writing to that drive, that's where the problem is. If you're just writing a file to it and then, you know, later on you read it back, whatever, that, you know, no problem with things like that. Other than the fact that just flash drives do fail. Even if you're not reading or writing constantly.
Right. And if guys care about this, for a woman, it's a lot sexier to see a guy with a terabyte drive in his shirt pocket than a pack of cigarettes.
Okay, moving along. Okay, next item is a share. Chris talked about password managers quite a bit in the past, and I just want to remind you that password managers are really useful. We're all concerned about hacking these days, and the manager will actually store long, complex passwords for any website that you use, and just as many websites that you have. Typically, the passwords are stored securely in an encrypted database, and they can be, and I say, this is my editorial comment, they should be stored on a local device, not in the cloud. You put it in the cloud, then somebody's going to hack it. And if you have it at home, then it's a lot more difficult. The neat thing about password managers is you only have to remember one master password. You access the encrypted database with that master password, and then you have access to all of the passwords that you've stored. For those of you who can't think up passwords easily, typically, they have a password generator, which generates random, strong passwords. And as Chris pointed out in his presentations, they're really neat because you can store more than just passwords. You can store phone numbers. You can put in the secret answers to those security questions that they always ask you, but you never know what the answer is anymore, especially if you've made it up. And the neat thing is you can attach documents and image files. So, for example, Chris said when he travels, he has an image of the front, the main page in his passport, which is, you know, a way to at least hopefully guarantee that you, if you lose your passport, you might be able to get it back faster. And then the other thing that they're useful for is they have autofill and auto login capabilities. I don't actually use that, but it's actually a neat little trick, and I'll show you how it works in a second. So let's think about logging into OPCUG and into our Google Groups system. So I have a menu. I just click on this menu, and it brings me to my login screen, and Google remembers who I am. It's got my user ID there. But now it wants a password, so I could just type it in. I mean, I use this thing all the time. I know what that password is. Let's suppose it's something, a really obscure website, and I don't remember the password. And so what I do is I open up my ePass, which is my password manager. I enter that master password and press OK, and it brings up the database. And so I scroll down, and you don't need to see all my usernames for all these sites, but if you go down to OPCUG, I've got a username stored, and I've got a password stored. So if I actually just double-click on this password, which is equivalent to the copy command, it now copies that password into the clipboard, and then I go back to my login screen, and I do a single click in the password field, then that's equivalent to paste. So now I've copied the password from my master database into Google. I hit next, and zingo, I'm now logged on to Google Groups. Now, supposing it's a more conventional website where Google's a really oddball. I mean, it's really weird in terms of it asks you which account you want to use, and then it wants a password and all that good stuff. Usually you log on to a website and it needs a user ID and a password, and they're generally on the same login screen, like this one for National Capital Freenet. So in this case, I've got an account for National Capital Freenet. I have a username and a password. All I have to do is do that same process twice. I just double click on the username, drop it into the username field, double click on the password, drop it into the password field, and then I can actually log in. But there's an easier way. Remember we talked about autofill and auto login? Well, KeePass calls this thing auto type. So it knows my user ID and my password once I've opened the database. So what I can do with this entry for NCF is I can enable auto type. And by default, it's going to use the default sequence of user ID and password, which actually is enter the username and then press tab, enter the password and then press enter. So it's going to do that automatically. And that's equivalent to me actually clicking in the username field, typing in my username, pressing tab, going to the password field, entering the password, and then pressing enter, log on. So sure enough, I can do that. I can go to this login screen. I can find my entry for the NCF in my database. I can either right click and bring up this context menu and say auto type, or I could actually highlight this account and then just do a control V, which is the short key, the hot key for auto type. So once I do one of those two things, I select auto type for that entry, then lo and behold, KeePass actually fills in these fields automatically, and I just have to hit login, and there we are in National Capital Freenet. So we talked about Google Groups, and I'm going to do a promo for Google Groups now. Everybody who's on this call tonight is accessible to the announcements group, so you can get an email from us, typically one on the weekend, telling you what's going on the next Wednesday, and then usually one at 6:30 or so, telling you what's going to happen that evening in an hour. You can also sign up, subscribe for the newsletter, and we'll send you an email with a PDF version of the newsletter attached. So both of those groups are available to anybody. The third group down here is only available to members. So if you try to access the member forum, it will ask you to log on, and you have to be a member to do that. So anybody who's a member, no problem. If you're not a member, $20 will fix that, as Chris said. Click on this link in the on the website and sign up for a membership. And if anybody has any problems with any of these groups, if you check in the how to link here, you'll find that Chris is willing and able to help you sort things out. So we look forward to everybody joining the members only group. Okay. So next up is Chris, who's going to talk a bit about VirusTotal.
Yeah, so probably most people on the call probably know about VirusTotal. We've talked about it numerous times. It's a way that you can actually go and check out any file or a URL and have it checked with usually about 70 different antivirus engines that are out there. So it's really, really useful. It can be accessed from a browser, and you can upload files for analysis, or you can submit URLs for analysis, and you'll get back a report in a minute or so on whether anything malicious was found. Next. I got an email just recently that VirusTotal is now available on mobile. And I guess because it's VirusTotal is actually owned by Google, it is available for the Android. It's not available currently on the iPhone platform. but it will scan all apps on your Android phone, and it will do both user apps or system apps. So it's two separate scans that you can run on it. It's very quick in how it runs. The reason is that it already knows about most apps. So basically, it'll take a signature of all of your apps, and then it will say, oh, okay, I know about this app already, and it can report on it whether it's malicious or not malicious. And then if it doesn't know about the app, you can actually submit any unknown apps, and they will analyze those. Or you can input any URLs for scanning analysis. And you can also submit any other files that just happen to exist on your phone for scanning and analysis. Next. So one thing that you have to keep in mind on this, it's very, very important, is that there is no real-time protection. So it is a point in time. If you download a new app onto your phone, it is not going to be scanned automatically by VirusTotal Mobile. So you have to manually launch the app on your phone and have it do the analysis for you. Next. Let's take a look at what it actually looks like. So this is if you open up the app on your phone and you have an alphabetic list of all apps that are installed on your phone. Next. So I said alphabetic, but you'll notice that Total Commander is not the first in the alphabet. And the reason why it is at the top of the list is that any problematic apps are surfaced to the top so that you'll see them rather than being buried down in a long, long list. So in this case here, I did a scan on my phone and it found one problematic app that had other than zero detected. And so this was detected by one scan engine as being a problem. Next. So I can tap that line and it'll bring up a little bit more details about that particular app. And I can see that it's Total Commander, one of 76 scan engines found it to be problematic. Next. But you'll notice that it actually said that it is clean. So I found that this was kind of curious because if you use VirusTotal on the web, just uploading from your desktop, it will never call something clean if it sees one problematic engine or anything like that. So I think the VirusTotal is now starting to rate things as if it thinks it's a false positive. And I'm not sure exactly algorithmically how it decides that one of them calling it problematic, it's still clean, but it does it that way. So next. So I can actually go to that at the top and tap on AV reports. Next. And it'll bring up an actual report that details which of the antivirus engines actually found it to be problematic. Now, it doesn't give you really anything more than that, but if you're interested in it, you can actually see if it's a popular antivirus engine. Like, I would give more weight to, say, if Symantec or Norton said that it was malicious rather than this unknown antivirus engine. I'm less concerned with it. So I guess that's how you can actually use that. Next. So what you have to do, though, all the time is scroll to the bottom of your list. And I wish that they actually surfaced these at the top as well, because these are unknown apps. So these are apps that are on your phone that VirusTotal has never seen before. And so they're just grayed out as being unknown. So you have to scroll to the bottom of the list to see it. Next. Once you get down to one of them and you tap on it, you'll have a little icon there that will allow you to tap on it to submit it for analysis. Next. And then a while later, usually a couple of minutes to 5 minutes later, if you look at the list again, you'll see that it will be sorted then at the top. So it'll either be in the alphabetic order if it's no problem with it, or it'll be at the top of the list if any of the engines finds it to be problematic. Next. So the other thing you can do is manually select a URL or a file to scan. Next. So you tap on the plus, and then you'll get two icons above it will appear. And you tap on the top one of a globe, and you'll be prompted to enter a URL, and it'll then scan that. Or you can tap on the file icon, and then it will allow you to browse on your phone to pick a file up to have it submitted for analysis. So that's it for VirusTotal Mobile. I find it's pretty good. I wish it did have some real-time capability, or at least that it would scan once a day or something like that and report it. It doesn't, but at least it lets you go through all of your apps and see at a point in time if they're all clean or not.
Okay, thank you, Chris. So moving along, Stuart Roos, as you recall, suggested looking at Canadian sites that have information that's interesting, and asked if other people had things to add to his list. Well, he's got a couple of things tonight, and the first one, Stuart, is your follow-up on ticks.
Ah, tickety-boo. Well, yeah, we have a website tonight called Can Lyme. Can you tell a lime? I can't tell a lime. Sorry, couldn't resist. But last week we talked about ticks, and the main reason we talked about ticks is because the gift they give us, and that's Lyme disease. And there's a whole bunch of reasons that's becoming more and more important for Canadians. And this website wants to help you identify that. So, as you see the URL on the screen, you can go to that URL, and there will be the resources to check out a tick bite and make sure it is a tick and all that, and then information on Lyme disease itself and the symptoms and diagnosis and treatment and prevention and living with it if you can't prevent it, and resources for doctors and resources for victims or patients, if you will. And it's really worthwhile information to look at, because we are really all responsible for our own health. We can't rely on the system to take care of us for us. And this is a fairly new item for the system, relatively new. So being aware is half the battle. Can Lyme might help you out. And I see Alan has tactics for avoiding Lyme or ticks, but this website's more about if you can avoid the ticks and you get the disease.
Actually, those tips are from that website.
Ah, well, I guess they want to help us too. Actually, the other reason I mentioned this website was because the last website, eTick, had a list of resources, and I noticed that the resources on this website and eTicks don't overlap that much. So there's different resources available between the two. So it's good knowing about both of them. And I'm not going to get into all the resources. You can read for yourselves. What else have we got, Alan? I've forgotten already. Oh, cross-border shopping. How could I forget about shopping? Yeah. The great Canadian pastime. I came across this website some time ago. And for some reason, it's really focused on the United States border. There are other countries in the world, but we seem to do most of our shopping there. And it's got a boatload of resources for dealing with your shopping over there or here and crossing over and coming back and keeping what you're carrying in either direction and paying for it. What I found of particular interest is if you go down to the second line, I believe, on the website, shopping online will give you a hint on what sort of duty you might expect to pay depending on what it is you're buying. And even if you're not going across the border, if you're just ordering something, as people have said, if it's not too expensive, you probably won't pay anything. But if you're buying something like, a Tesla, and you can't be bothered to go down and get it yourself, in your hand. This might help you calculate the duty you're going to pay on shipping it up here. There are shipping costs. Well, yes, actually one of the items is the auto import guide and Black Friday specials. It's a handy tool for people that like to shop in the States. And given the difference between the Canadian dollar today and the United States dollar, it's definitely worth keeping track of your pennies on this one. I'm afraid that's all I've got this week, folks.
Okay, thanks, Stuart. As it turns out, Tom heard your plea, and he has a whole raft of what he calls loony links. So, Tom, here's your first
take it away, Tom.
Where's Tom going?
That should be better. Okay. Red Flag Deals is a Canadian website that has lots of hot deals. There's about 30 new postings every day on things, cheap beer, Alan, and other things. And it's worthwhile if you're interested in looking for deals or looking for something. You can also do searches on it and such, so it's useful that way. And you can set up email alerts if you're looking for something, you know, a particular product. You can set up email alerts on it to be able to get apprised of that thing showing up. So next, this is the Knowledge Network. I found it on Roku, but you may be able to find an Android app for it. I don't know. It's something that is very much like TVO. You can also access it online on your browser and view different documentaries and dramas. So it's another opportunity for you. Regarding weather, I tend to use my my phone to do the weather, but now and then I look at this Canadian weather map for radar, basically for rain and stuff. But you can also look at weather stats, and that gives you a very good comprehensive look at the weather. It's something that is very far more comprehensive and usable than the weather website, the weather.ca website. And Stock Tracker. If you're interested in a particular thing, this is often referenced in Red Flag Deals. You can often look at where things are in different stores, and there's a variety of stores, Walmart, Staples, and so on. I don't know how they do it, but they look at the stock that's available online and in each particular store, whether it's available and what price it's listed at. I don't know where they get this information from. It's really amazing. But if you're looking for a particular thing, especially if you need it kind of within a day or two, then this is very useful to look to see what's available online, better than Google, for looking for stuff from Canada. Next.
I just note that you can either enter a stock number, an SKU number, or you can actually search for the item in words, and it will typically find it.
Yes, you can also enter the SKU is the number that the store gives it. It's a stock keeping unit, but you can also look for the UPC. So, for example, you could I haven't checked whether there's an app for it, but you could scan the UPC on a shelf, for example, and then see if it's available elsewhere at a cheaper price.
Okay.
Oh, To-Do Canada. This is a whole bunch of sites. It's unfortunately, they list them in sort of reverse chronological order. I have no idea why. But it sings across Canada. It's mainly paid stuff. But they have other things like the Tulip Festival and things on there. But it's usable. It's up to date. You can see how it's on for the week in Ottawa or Montreal or wherever. And there's usually a dozen or two entries. So it's quite, if you're interested in mainstream entertainment, it's all there for you.
And finally,
mobile syrup. You can look at the whole website is stuff about mobile information and such that you can look at. But one of the things they do is take a look at the what is available currently from different providers, the big providers and the little ones too. So you can compare different plans because they give you all kinds of alternatives so you get confused. But this will give you a little bit of a common way to look at them all to choose a mobile plan if yours is coming up for renewal or if you are getting a new plan for some reason, if you're getting into the 21st century.
Okay, thanks very much, Tom. Some good sites there, I think. Okay, next up we have a follow-up from B, but I think Chris is going to talk to this.
Yeah, I put together these slides from information that B sent in. Last week, B mentioned that during the ChatGPT talks that she had some information about medical focus on using ChatGPT, and she sent me a bunch of the links. So the links here, and I will just paste these in right now. So there were four documents that she actually sent me. And so the first one was the title was ChatGPT Flunks Gastroenterology Exam. And it was interesting. ChatGPT-4, which is the latest version, it scored 62% and the minimum passing grade is 70. And there's an MD there, Regional Director of Endoscopy at Northwell Health, said that an actual physician should score 99% or at least 95%. So that's a pretty bad score. Living on the MD Edge was another one, and it said medical level empathy. Yep, ChatGPT can fake that. And so ChatGPT was more empathetic than human doctors. So at a rate 10 times better than human doctors were, 45% versus 4.6% for human doctors. So that was kind of interesting. And then a couple of just general warnings and overviews on things. The WHO is warning against bias and misinformation in using chat, any AI in healthcare. And then also there was one on asking the question, will AI perpetuate or eliminate health disparities? And so just a couple of interesting discussion items on that. So thanks very much, B, for sending that information in. And if you're interested in it from a health point of view using AI, take a look at those four articles from Medscape.
Okay, thanks, Chris. So I just put a note in the chat that we're in the last 5 or 6 minutes here, and we have one item from Bob Harris, but we can postpone that if anybody has any questions that they desperately need an answer to right now. Not seeing anything in the chat, though. I may just open it up for Bob. So, Bob, let's see how far we get.
Okay, great. Thank you all. I've been following some of this ChatGPT stuff and having lots of fun with this. The next screen, please. ChatGPT just entered a new feature. You can share, when you search for something, instead of copying and pasting the data, you can now share the actual link so that your friends can see the actual stuff that you were trying to show them before. The next screen, please. And in this instance, I was sharing a chat about the pros and cons of air fryers. You click copy the link at the bottom. You can copy and paste that into an email. And it makes it a lot easier. It's a new feature in ChatGPT. And next, please. This one is something totally different. Wisdolia, another AI powered skill. It instantly creates questions and answers in the form of flashcards. So if you want to study for an exam, I installed this as a Chrome extension. And you can throw in some text or a website, and it'll scan through it and instantly nail off question and answer flashcards for easy studying. Now, for several days, I was truly impressed by this. Then I realized how stupid and old school I was, because ChatGPT can have this skill already. You just need to ask it. Show it the text, and it'll give you the questions and answers you want. It's my old skill abilities that are holding me back. So Wisdolia is outdated by the skills once you learn how to do it properly. So next, please. And ChatGPT, I believe, runs on Chat 3.5. Perplexity AI, if you haven't tried it, is worth signing up for it. I use my Google account to sign up for it. I guess it uses Chat GPT-4. That means it's up to the current data. Like ChatGPT goes back to September 2021. This uses contemporary data and very efficient. It's also free. Now, I put on here that it's limited uses, but I've been using it a whole lot, I mean a ton. And so far, I'm still going full speed ahead for free. I haven't paid at all. So next screen, please. This is another, I have a very slim wallet, but the cost went to $83 to buy one. So this has a great information. In 2 seconds, gave me the alternative wallets. It gave me websites, a ton of data instantly. And this is all current data up to the minute. You can ask for the fires in Nova Scotia, wherever you want to look. It's all current data. And next screen, please. Now, getting back to Perplexity AI, you have to sign up to use it. You must sign up for it. And I see Chris posted in the stuff. Now, if I share a link of my inquiry with Perplexity AI, you can in turn see my actual query. This is a silly question. In Canada, which grocery stores have seen the biggest price spikes in the last 6 months? The question is not important. But if you click on the link in the chat, it'll open in your browser and you will be able to try a follow-up question to this when you'll see the actual answer, and you'll be actually using Perplexity AI. If you go further, once you open your window, you can do it right now. If you have two windows open on your computer, it'll show you, first of all, the inquiry had nine items and five hot links. It gives you the actual links that it found for your data. You can ask your own follow-up question, or better yet, on the top left of the page in your browser, you can open new thread and you'll be able to start your own brand new prompt without signing up. You can try it. You have two screens now. You can try it right away and you'll be able to use Perplexity AI for free. I don't know for how long. If you don't sign up, this might even work for you. Anyway, next screen, please. And the last one is follow the elephant's reminder. When you use your Perplexity AI, which is a version of Chat, I think it's version 4. You don't know if that's a question. You can give it a command. You can tell it to sort your grocery list by the alphabet. You can sort your list by the department store produce, meat, whatever. You can ask as much detail as you want. It'll always come back to you. And then going back to Wisdolia, that's already outdated because if you know how to ask the right question, it'll do anything for you. So can anybody see that right now and use that feature? If you have two screens? Did it work? I don't know.
Nobody's saying anything, Bob.
I did a follow-up on your link there, your query, and I said, how much have eggs gone up in price And it says, according to the search results, egg prices in Canada climbed 16.5% year over year in December 2022, and goes on from there.
Cool. So you're actually using.
Yeah.
I think you're in an anonymous account, I believe.
Yeah. I've not signed on to. I didn't sign up for Perplexity at all, so it does work.
So the intent is that everybody else can click on that link without signing up and get the benefits. I don't know how long it'll last or how many can use it, but
yeah. Certainly seems to work for follow-ups, yeah.
And it's still free now, so I would encourage everybody to get in there, muck around, and have fun before you start paying for it.
Okay, thanks, Bob.
Thank you, everybody.
Let everybody check that out later on, I guess, have the link in the chat window there. Now, any other questions? And Jocelyn's put a note in the chat that the information field at the bottom of the screen normally shows the temperature, but sometimes it shows information that's truncated. And for example, right now it's saying to him, closed road on Rue E. He says, is there any way to see the whole text? Anybody know the answer to that one?
I guess to start, the question is, what info field, what screen?
It must be that news and
weather
thing, wasn't it?
Yeah, news and interests.
Yeah, I have it turned off, so I don't know.
Yeah, I've turned it off long ago. I would just click on the icon itself for news and interests, if that is what you're talking about, Joss, and it should bring up a panel. Bigger. If you have it in the default state, even just hovering over that would have it come up with a more detailed screen. But I'm not sure if that's what you're talking about, news and interests.
Yes, that's what I'm talking about. Is on the bar at the bottom, and I click on it, it gives other news, but nothing, it never shows what that truncated text was.
Oh, I see, okay.
Don't drive down that road, Jocelyn.
What road?
I don't know.
Maybe we'll take that one under advisement and see if we can come up with an answer an answer next week.
I found News and Interest to be a very annoying little app, and I turned it off long ago.
Yeah.
All right, so... finishing off tonight, we're in the just over the hour here. It's the last call for PizzaQ next week. So if you're an OPCUG member and you want to go to PizzaQ and you haven't signed up yet, you need to register by sending an email to pizzaparty@opcug.ca. And then when you get to Britannia Park at the trolley station, you'll find pizza waiting and ready for you. But you must register.
And drinks and cupcakes, too.
And cupcakes, too, right. And Karen came up with an interesting thing. She wants to know about what's worth watching on YouTube. She thinks that some members must know gems that would be of interest. So what videos or channels on YouTube would you recommend? Now, we're going to restrict the suggestions to technical computer-related items because everybody watches cute cats and baby videos, but we're not interested in those. We just want the hardcore technical stuff. And we don't have any no Q&A next week, so you've got 2 weeks to think about your best YouTube videos and channels that you'd recommend to members to watch.
I would suggest if you send in something, send in the URL and just a one-liner on why you think that this is a useful site.
Sounds good. All right. So as I said, there's no Q&A next week because we'll be in the open air at the Britannia Park. So the next Q&A will be on the 21st of June. So you've got 2 weeks to think up questions or answers to Jocelyn's question on obscure roads in Ottawa somewhere. Topics that you'd like to share, like Bob Harris and Tom with his Loony Links, and of course the YouTube videos and channels for Karen. So lots of things to think about, and hopefully we'll see you all at Pizza Party next week, and if not, at Q&A in 2 weeks. So hope everybody enjoyed tonight. Lots of good stuff, I think, and we'll see you when we see you.
Thanks, folks. Hope to see you out at Britannia Park.